I'm Christopher Leiden, and this is Open Source. Quick plug before our Steve Brill conversation for our fundraiser underway. We're a lean, independent nonprofit that lives for listeners and needs your support for smart talk about ideas, the arts, and politics. Pitch in, please, right now at Kickstarter.com under Projects. Search for Open Source. Watch our video and give what you can to keep us freewheeling and free. Send us $25 and we'll send you the buried treasure of our classic hour with the late, great David Foster Wallace from 1996. Thank you for checking us out. And now the Brill Show. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Steve Brill is our guest. He's an old-fashioned reporter at book length out of the David Halberstam School. He's taken apart the passage of Obamacare in an investigation he titled America's Bitter Pill. Short form, it's the story of a messy democracy awash in special interest money, trying to reform a messy healthcare system itself awash in money and private powers. There were many steps taken in good directions, Steve Brill would tell you, and still our politics and our doctoring both need emergency care.
I saw the book as a way to demonstrate with a narrative style, with all the whole roller coaster ups and downs, what happens in this country when what has become a dysfunctional, money-driven government attempts to fix or reform a dysfunctional part of our economy, which in fact is one-sixth of our economy, in fact is arguably the most important consumer product we all buy, which is healthcare. And in fact, is an economy the size of France. So what happens when a government that has been overrun by lobbyists tries to do something called reform of the healthcare system? And what happens is that all the healthcare interests that are hiring all those lobbyists end up doing better than before you had reform. That's the bad news. The prices are still way too high. That's the bad news. The good news is that 10 to 20 million more Americans now have access to health care, which is fast erasing what has been a long time national disgrace, which is that among the developed countries in the world, we're the only one of them that hasn't done something to make sure most, if not all, of our citizens have access to health care.
So the 10 million, the new ones, you could say, have been fed into a system that absolutely nobody can afford.
No one can afford and nobody understands. And the only people who can afford it are the ones who are riding the gravy train. And that doesn't include the doctors and the nurses who actually provide the care. It includes executives at medical device makers. It includes CAT scan salesmen. It includes hospital CEOs who typically make millions of dollars a year and always make more than the president of the university that they're associated with.
Which is or the doctors and nurses that are actually
way more than
holding
the
patients.
Nurses. Yeah. I mean, in fact, our country, our system is so upside down that there are twice as many people working in the health insurance industry, processing paper and sending out bills, than there are doctors providing care.
We're also remembering that in Boston, we're talking about our proudest, oldest industry, still huge glory to this town. But we're mystified by the questions that don't come up in this kind of presentation of a
well, let's
of a
talk
plan.
About Boston. I mean, you say oldest, proudest industry, which is healthcare, Mass General, Brigham and Women's. There's another big industry related to healthcare in Massachusetts, and that's the medical device industry. Now, the medical device industry is one of the most profitable industries. Their profit margins are through the roof. The leading medical device maker, Medtronic, has much higher profit margins even than Apple. So part of the Obamacare law that made some sense was they put a tax of 3%, an excise tax of 3% on all medical devices, all durable medical equipment, as they call it. Now, that was the rationale was, well, we're about to give the people who make pacemakers and artificial hips and artificial knees and neurostimulators for your back that nobody really needs, but everybody gets. We're about to give them tens of millions of new customers. Let's get a little bit of a tax on them. It's a excise tax, which means it's not just on domestic companies, it's on foreign companies. And the industry howled. They said, this is a jobs killer. This is a profit killer. It's terrible. And it wasn't just the Republicans. In Washington, when it comes to healthcare lobbying, it is bipartisan. The sainted Elizabeth Warren is trying to get that tax repealed. Right. Al Franken is trying to get that tax repealed, as well as the Republicans. It's the one sort of bipartisan thing going on Capitol Hill is let's repeal the medical device tax because their tentacles are so deep on Capitol Hill. Now, is it a jobs killer? Is it a profits killer? Well, let's look at Medtronic. Since Obamacare was signed, Medtronic's profit is up 67%, and it's added more than 5,000 people to the payroll. Doesn't sound like a jobs killer. Doesn't sound like a profits killer. And it stands logic on its head. If you suddenly create all these new people who have health insurance who can buy artificial hips and knees and buy pacemakers and buy stents and do all this other stuff that give companies like Medtronic so much profit, or Boston Scientific.
I was going to
so
say, Boston profit. Scientific is probably not far behind.
You know, Obamacare is a gravy train for these companies. And the idea that 3% tax has hurt them is just hilarious. There's just no evidence of it.
Boston is also the home of RomneyCare, which was the father of Obamacare, and the child, in a way, of Dukakis and other efforts at universal health care in Massachusetts. But question, why is it so hard, even here, but certainly at the national level, to even question the role of private insurance?
Well, the reason is that the politics of that are just impossibly unrealistic. If we could roll the clock back to 1943, we could do it. In 1943, a little-known a government agency called the War Labor Board, which President Roosevelt charged with making sure that price controls and wage controls were enforced during World War II, met, and they had a problem. A lot of employers were starting to try to get around the freeze on wages by offering their employees health insurance because health costs were starting to become relevant. There were some drugs like penicillin. There were now ways to treat the sick. So people were starting to spend, you know, 5-6% of the GDP on health care. So these employers said, well, you know, here's a great way around the freeze on wages. We'll lure workers and we'll keep workers by giving them health insurance. So the War Labor Board met and had to consider whether that would count as a wage increase. And in a decision where I have yet to find a news clip anywhere, they decided it's not a wage increase. They can do it. And there was a flood of health insurance bought by employers for their employees. That started the private health insurance industry in the United States, where it pretty much doesn't exist almost anywhere else. Then a follow-on decision by the Internal Revenue Service declared, well, since the War Labor Board said it's not a wage increase, then it's not really taxable income either. So it won't be taxed. Once you embedded that benefit into so many Americans, such a large constituency, the pressure to provide, you know, government-provided health insurance, which was spreading all over the world, wasn't there because so many people had insurance. Worse, the great irony is that the interest group that was most against providing government insurance during the 1940s, when Roosevelt was thinking about it, were the labor unions. Because the labor unions were now bargaining to get insurance in their contracts, and they used the fact that they could get you health insurance as a recruiting tool. So they pressured Roosevelt not to include health insurance in any of his New Deal packages, and then they opposed it when Harry Truman wanted to do it. So it never got included when it might have been, because they basically had released the pressure valve because so many people now had insurance at work. Then when Lyndon Johnson gets elected, reelected in 64 and passes Medicare in 65, that takes another huge constituency out of the mix in terms of pushing for national health care, because, you know, suddenly everybody 65 or older has health insurance. So what you're left with are people who don't have jobs, or who have jobs where employers don't provide insurance, which in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s wasn't that large a group of people.
It comes up all the time now that there's no very, very good reason to attach insurance to a particular company or even to an employer or even to employment.
And by the way,
why is it so hard, though, to detach it?
Because employers like it, you know, executives like it because it's tax-free income and their income tax rates at high levels of earnings are high. What I explain in the book is how we have become, healthcare has become an alternate economic universe where everything's different. You know, a lot of us actually heard something about a recession, you know, the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009. The healthcare industry never got that memo. They had no recession. Drug company CEOs, hospital CEOs, their incomes just kept going up. Hospital CEOs' incomes have averaged an increase of 22% in the last 2 years, and doctors' incomes have averaged an increase of 1%. Just think about that.
You write, Steve Brill, at the very end of this fascinating book that we have now, with the Affordable Care Act, in effect, paid a huge money ransom to the industry. But the hope at the end of the book is that we can now force, through the sticker shock of all these prices, force the industry to get some cost reductions.
Right. And in fact, when RomneyCare was passed here in Massachusetts, and I should hasten to say that Obamacare is a slightly more conservative Republican version of RomneyCare. Obamacare really mirrors a bunch of proposals Richard Nixon made in the 70s to head off Ted Kennedy's more liberal proposals. That's what Obamacare is. The people involved who I interviewed for the book were very candid about this, and they were candid at the time. They said, well, we can, you know, there are two problems with healthcare in the United States. People, you know, more people need coverage. They don't have coverage. And the costs are just obscene. And what they decided was, well, the politics of dealing with costs, even in Massachusetts, are impossible. We're not going to be able to deal with costs. But let's go get coverage. So we'll get people coverage, and then we'll deal with costs later. And in fact, when more people have coverage, the costs will be so high and so glaring that there'll be a crisis, and we'll have to do something about costs.
That's the sticker shock part.
And the first part worked out. They got the coverage. They're still working on the second part.
Steve, what about President Obama himself? He came into the campaign not really well briefed. He didn't think he liked the idea of mandated insurance at all. Had a bitter fight with Hillary about that. And to the end, he didn't seem to get deeply involved with a sharp pencil and questioning the numbers and the details. What's his piece of the story in the long term?
I'd say three different pieces. First of all, at the beginning, not only didn't he agree with Hillary Clinton about the individual mandate, it's the only instance, it turns out, during his primary contest with her where he wrote attack literature. Attacking, it's the one issue he attacked Hillary Clinton on, that she's going to make you buy unaffordable health insurance. And I'm
she
not.
Said, shame on you, Barack.
And she had this press conference, and you know, it's one of the indelible news clips from the 2008 primary where she says, shame on you, Barack Obama. That's what it was about. It was him distributing literature, accusing her of wanting to have a mandate that people had to buy health insurance. So that's the first thing. He wasn't that into the details at the beginning. Second, he really did dive in, and once he decided to go for reform, he met a lot of people, as I explain in the book, and as he explains to me in the book, he met people on the campaign trail who just had, you know, and all the candidates who just had these terrible stories. If they had insurance, their insurance didn't cover anything close to what they needed to have covered. They couldn't get insurance because they had pre-existing conditions. All the horror stories, he heard them, and he decided that he really was going to make health reform a high priority, and even decided after the inauguration, when a lot of his aides were saying, you know, let's just worry about the economic stimulus, let's just worry about the economy, he bought into the idea that healthcare is in large part about fixing the economy, and that he insisted on doing it. He tells me in the book, you know, I just insisted on the idea that we could chew gum and walk at the same time. Deserves an enormous amount of credit for that. And then during the fight over it, there were a bunch of instances when, as the Tea Party rose up in 2009, when it looked like it was totally dead, and he, almost alone among the people in the White House, stuck to it. Mm-hmm. That's the good news. The bad news starts on the night that the law is passed. There's a scene in the book where he has a champagne celebration for his staff that night on the Truman balcony in the White House. And he gives a little talk, and the entirety of the talk, as was recounted to me by several of his aides, was we now have to rise up to the challenge of getting people to enroll. And one person who, believe it or not, this still happens in Washington, kept a daily diary of this staff person's work in the White House, recorded in the staff person's diary that night, quote, assumption that passage equals implementation, very troubling. And where Barack Obama failed miserably was he forgot that part of being president is actually governing. It's not just passing a law, but then you implement the law. And if the law is the most complicated legislation passed in decades and involves the most complicated website, e-commerce site ever attempted by anyone, you got to pay attention. And he paid no attention to it. His staff didn't. There were some people on the staff who said, you got to bring in people from the outside who understand this stuff. And he instead let the ideologues on the policy team be in charge of the implementation. And they didn't know what they were doing. And the disaster came on October 1st of 2013 when they launched the website and it crashed. The night before the launch of the website, Obama's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, was so clueless about how it was going to go, as was the president, McDonough called around to friends saying, we're going to knock your socks off tomorrow morning when we turn on the website. Well, he was right, but not quite in the way he meant. So that's a downside, but he deserves enormous credit. First of all, then learning his lesson, he brings people in from Silicon Valley and they fix the website pretty quickly. But he deserves enormous credit for sticking with it. And another kind of credit, because what the result of Obamacare is that Barack Obama owns the healthcare system in America. Now, when HR people meet with employees and they say, we've got to raise your deductibles, we've got to raise your coinsurance, they all say it's because of Obamacare. It has nothing to do with Obamacare. They've been doing that for 15 years. It's not about Obamacare, but everything about healthcare is now associated with the president.
He's got ownership now forever.
Yeah, and he knew it. I mean, he had to know it, and he did know it, and he deserves credit for taking it on.
Steve Brill, I want to go very, very big picture on all of this and about the country itself, this country we barely understand. But I'm thinking in 500 years from now, if there is such a thing, people will look at 21st century America. I think they will wonder what other country in history facing the universal, endless fear of illness and of death, the great equalizer, what other country could afford to throw trillions and trillions of dollars at it and not bat an eye, which is what we're doing.
Democracies generally, this one in particular, this one especially once money really takes over the way it has, you know, our election redistricting process, our lobbying process. The problem with healthcare is it's one explanation of benefits and one bill at a time. And it's this slow motion crisis. You know, 2 years ago, we thought it was a disaster that $2.6 trillion was being spent on healthcare in the United States. This year, it's going to be $3.2 trillion. You know, that's a lot of money, but there's no precipitating event. And you know, America often needs a crisis to do something.
Steve Brill, you've given us a very different way to think about the whole thing. A dysfunctional democracy, rebuilding a dysfunctional healthcare system, both of them raging fevers with a virus of money. I love the moment in your dream. There you are in your Johnny in a New York Presbyterian bed, and the multi-million-dollar salaried president of the hospital comes and says, we know who you are. We know what you're writing. We know what you know about us. Beware.
Right. Just as my reporting was coming to an end in the spring, it was the last day of enrollment in Obamacare, and I'm tracking Obamacare very closely, and I'm obsessed with all this stuff, as only you become when you're writing a book like this. During a routine checkup, my doctor discovered that I needed urgent open heart surgery because I had something called an aortic aneurysm where you have no symptoms at all. I mean, I felt great. I'd worked out that day. So 3 days later, I'm in the hospital. And it's sort of a surreal experience because I'm thinking every moment of my life about hospitals and healthcare and medical bills. And suddenly I'm in one. And it's the night before my surgery. And that's the dream I have, which is that I knew the salary of the CEO and I had said it was too high. And I'm this really tough reporter who suddenly is strapped into a gurney and in the dream, the CEO of the hospital stops and says, "We know you're here for undercover work. We're not letting you go." And I beg him to let me in. And I say, I'd written about the $67 gauze pads. And I say in the dream, I don't care if you charge $67 for gauze pads. I'll take 100 boxes of them if you want. Just let me in and let me have my surgery. Well, the dream actually has a real point to it, which is the reason that healthcare and healthcare politics is so difficult and toxic is when you're sick or when a loved one is sick, you're not thinking about healthcare policy and healthcare economics. You're thinking about healthcare. You're thinking about that person getting well. And you don't want the government messing with it. You don't want the insurance company messing with it. You don't want anyone to tell you not to spend XYZ dollars to do it. You don't want to hear that, you may not need this. You should wait. You don't want to take any chances. That's all totally justifiable, but it makes healthcare a very different product.
Steve Brill, thank you so much for this bitter pill and maybe a brighter future.
Thank you.
Stephen Brill's new book is America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. For more smart talk on arts, ideas, and politics, go to radioopensource.org and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you're ready to step up with support for year two of this project, hop over to Kickstarter right now and help us out. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you.